too many bills coming due at once. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and just ahead, why Jacksonville leaders will have to make some painful choices to get the city's financial house in order. What are your questions and thoughts? Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, our First Coast Connect book club shares listeners' memories of their first time in an airplane as we look inside David McCullough's The Wright Brothers. Lots of your emails to share there. Plus, celebrating the coastal heritage of the Gullah Geechee people, will tell you about this month's big festival in St. Augustine. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, tough choices ahead for Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry and the City Council. A recent 90-day audit of the city's finances revealed serious problems ahead, with unsustainable budget deficits and looming challenges coming down the road, from those pension obligations to how to pay for an expensive dredging project for the St. Johns River and more. The number crunchers from Ernst & Young also say our city's taxes are too low to sustain all of this, but raising them is politically a non-starter for the Curry administration. So where will the rubber meet the road? Well, A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics has been digging through the numbers and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And when it comes to how to fix the city's financial mess, what are your thoughts? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. We have so many comments already on our Facebook page. We'll get to those in a moment. And as you wrote in Florida Politics, and I'm quoting, it's uglier than Wacko's at last call. Gee. The other colorful phrase, as you write, A.G. Gankarski, is that when it comes to the city of Jacksonville, we are Brizoke.
Yeah, I'm using the Carney slang there as a measure of the financial situation. I have to go to City Hall after this, and I'm leaving my wallet in the car. I don't want it to be confiscated for paying
man.
For anything. But really what it boils down to is our millage rates have been too low, you know, for too long. If our millage rates were raised to the average level of Florida cities, we'd have $40 million more dollars in the coffer. You got situations like the Shands issue. If Jacksonville were statutorily allowed to have an indigent care tax, that'd be $75 million, which would put Shands on significantly better financial footing. And what we've seen with this austerity plan that we've had since 2008, you know, is brought in by necessity, you know, by John Payton and basically followed by the, you know, following mayor, is we've seen an attrition in, you know, city staffers that affects, you know, issue after issue. You look at something like code enforcement. You know, Lenny Curry had a code enforcement sweep over Eureka Gardens, and that's great. But Jacksonville has 27 code enforcement people compared to a city like Orlando or Miami that's got three times that many. You know, so these resources are coming from somewhere. And, you know, you look at things like the infrastructure, the roads, the sidewalks, drainage, stormwater, you name it. All of it's been affected by politicians that have, you know, mistaken austerity for fiscal conservatism, and now the bills are coming due.
549-2937 to join us. And when we talk about the bills coming due, let's list them. We've got pension obligations.
Right.
We've got a potential dredging project for the river that the business community, the mayor's office, the Duval delegation, the chamber all say is a must-do, running into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And what else?
We've got those issues. You know, we've got a stormwater infrastructure backlog. We've got the need to hire more police officers because the sheriff's office has shrunk in the last couple of decades. Even though the population of the city has grown, the areas that are actually being serviced have grown. We need more fire stations and, you know, firemen, period, and, you know, so on. I mean, you can name the issue and you can see the effects of what is essentially is fiscal starvation.
And so, given that this parade of horribles is before Mayor Curry and the city council, and also given that when former Mayor John Payton raised the millage rate during his second term and faced an incredible backlash for it, it would seem that at least in his first term as mayor, Lenny Curry is not going to be predisposed toward a revenue increase. So what's the city left with?
Yeah, I mean, he's rolled out the tax increases, and, you know, indeed, he's used a lot of political capital on things like board and commission moves. You know, he's basically, you know, whipped up the political opposition on those rather than, you know, driving toward more of a, you know, posture of we've got to get to fiscal solvency. Curry does say he has a plan regarding the pension that, you know, he's working out with Tallahassee. He might be able to debut that early this year, or early next year, rather. It remains to be seen. He won't be specific about that plan. So, you know, people ask him, I've asked him, people run Times Union and so on, but, you know, getting a specific answer is elusive. So, I mean, it leaves us with, you know, basically borrowing. It leaves us with, you know, a sales tax increase, a millage tax increase. I mean, there's only a few things you can really do to get the revenue right. I mean, you've got $250 million in banking fund, you know, credits been expended right now. I mean, that's serious money in light of the city's budget.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937 as we discuss a recent 90-day audit of the city's finances. At a recent economic roundtable of Jacksonville meeting, Mayor Curry did talk about how he would work with the Rick Scott administration to access state funds to work on the city's finances. You mentioned the flap over boards and commissions in Jacksonville. What do you think about the theory that the Curry administration is cleaning out the JEA board so that perhaps they can position JEA to contribute more revenue to Jacksonville's stressed coffers and shore up the finances that way?
That very clearly is happening. You saw the exit of Peter Bauer, who resisted Alvin Brown's pension plan that involved JEA. And other people, you're seeing people that are loyal to Curry being brought in. And, you know, honestly, it's something where if you get the board right, you can get the agreement right. And the negotiations between the JEA board and the city have been very contentious on this. You go to a JEA agreement meeting and, you know, basically see the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, what they're going to have to do is find a way to make the agreement more favorable to the city. The problem is there is that that's going to come into your electric bills, your water bills, your sewer bill, and so on. So some people will say, well, that's a hidden tax, and it's hard to disagree with that.
And how will the mayor deal with that political blowback? Is that something that City Hall can then put back on the utility and let the utility take the blame for any potential rate increase?
I think that's a pretty transparent ploy. I think people are going to be looking at those bills very closely, and it's something that the public information shop, you know, of the Curry administration is going to have to find a way to message, and going to have to find a way to message proactively. You know, knowing that the audit was out there last week, you know, it surprises me that, you know, Curry didn't actually launch it in an official version before going to London. Because the draft version was in the Daily Record. I had access to the draft version. I'm sure the Times Union did also. And, you know, when the official version comes out in a week or so, people can be scrutinizing that for changes. Like, well, what changed between the draft version and the official version? So the longer they let the narrative fester at City Hall, the more questions are going to be raised.
And lots of calls, emails, and tweets, and Facebook comments. Lots of Facebook comments as we discuss the city's 90-day audit looking at major financial issues for Jacksonville, what to do about them as we go to your calls right now. What are your thoughts? 549-2937. Tim and Yuli. Hi, Tim. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Melissa. How you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Good. Yeah, you know, I've been here in Jacksonville for nearly about 10 years, and it seems like the same conversation comes up over and over about, you know, raising taxes and things like that. You know, I drive around this town, you know, and I see how, you know, the infrastructure is going downhill. So, I mean, I guess my question is, why isn't it an option to raise taxes so that we become more viable? And here's another one. Why not toll some of our roads and bridges? I mean, I ride down South Florida. You know, I was just in Orlando. You know, some of those roads are tolled. You know, I know to bring revenue here. I know people don't like to hear it. But I know that would be an option here because I know people drive, you know, they come here into Jacksonville and they drive straight through heading to Miami, the Tampas and Orlando's, but they never stop. So why not toll our roads so that we can bring more revenue into the city? Thanks. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thank you, Tim.
I wrote a column a couple of years ago for Folio Weekly about that very issue, tolling at the county line, getting the people coming from St. Johns County for work or coming from Nassau County, as this gentleman would be, for work. And it was a very unpopular column. Republicans, Democrats, Independents, they all objected to it. And, you know, regarding the infrastructure, you know, the real issue is this. I mean, you talk to people on the north side, northwest quadrant, the west side, and they say it's the tale of two Jacksonvilles. I heard it yesterday at the NICE committee meeting at City Hall. One side of Jacksonville has new infrastructure, has, drains that work and so on. The other side, you've got, roads that look like they were bombed out, like Beirut in 1982.
It's been that way for many decades,
yes,
too.
I mean, the promise of consolidation a half century ago was that there were going to be fixes in these areas. And these fixes have yet to manifest.
And the toll issue goes back to the history of tolls in Jacksonville. Don't you think former Mayor Tommy Hazzouri, famously during his term as mayor, got rid of the toll? Tolls seem to be just still to this day a non-starter in Jacksonville, even though they would bring in the revenue, because people just don't want them to come back.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. People, don't like to think about paying as they go. But in reality, I mean, that's sound financing. You want to build these roads. You want to build, an infrastructure for transportation. And you've got to find a way to pay for it. And the city's got to be creative in the solution. And they've got to find a way to message that, the time of, waiting for the next generation to pay it off is over. I mean, basically, the audit is saying that if we don't find a way to get revenue into the system by fiscal year 2017, which is next fiscal year, you're going to be in deficit spending. You're going to be tapping into the emergency reserve. And that is something that the people in city council don't want to happen. You got through a really nice budget where you found all the money, and basically legacy funds for capital. That's not going to happen again. There's not $58 million sitting in these legacy funds. So, and they, propose an ambitious capital improvement program. All of that is to say they've got to find a way to pay for things, and tolls have to be on the table along with everything else.
Bill in Avondale. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
And yet we spend how many millions of dollars on having the world's biggest jumbotrons, as if we couldn't settle for the second biggest? But my main comment is this, directed to Mr. Gankorski's comment about the millage rate. That's part of the problem. Another big part of the problem, in my view, is that too many properties are underassessed by the property appraiser. And there needs to be some correction for that, and it would produce a lot of millions of dollars for the city if assessments were proper. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Okay. What about his comment?
I hope Jerry Holland is listening because...
The current property appraiser.
Right. The previous property appraiser, a lot of people basically made the claim that when you get properties that are over, say, $400,000, there was an underappraising there. And, that's something that... If you're a property appraiser and you're in a time that's a relative economic boom in terms of the real estate market, you want to be looking at that a little bit more closely. And, I'm sure Jerry Holland is reviewing procedures in his office and figuring out a way to get more revenue, out of, property values. The question is that going to be able to happen in time before the inevitable dip in the real estate market is going to happen in the next couple of years?
And here's a related email from David. Wow, after years of corporate welfare, giving millions to developers and not charging impact fees, passing the cost of the new infrastructure on to taxpayers, they still won't put impact fees on the table. That's rich. He sends an email to the show. Here are a couple of tweets from Crystalis. The indigent care tax makes sense, and Chicago residents advocated for it to take care of people with mental illness. Miami has a tax for the homeless. We need some sort of tax increase to improve our city, she writes. Let us know whether you agree with that. Call us up. We'll go to your Facebook comments in a moment at 5. And then right now it's 549-2937. Richard in Riverside. Go ahead, Richard.
Yes. We have one revenue source that we haven't explored. That is the air we breathe. Why can't we... find out, we have the technology to find out how much air an individual breathes, and we could broaden the base. We have a good broad base, and we could actually tax people on the amount of air they take out of it. Now you can, they can
what?
Do it by the input. Yeah.
What sure. are you talking about, man?
I'm talking about revenue. I'm talking about money. It's right there. People can for the air they breathe, they can just as well be taxed on that. I mean, you got the storm water fee now, so why not that?
Okay, I think Richard's having a little fun with us, but thanks for the call. AG.
Well, you know, that actually points to a concern that people have is...
Yeah, that everything will be taxed.
Itemized taxation.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
You know, that's the reality of it. That's the reality of a city. The money is coming from somewhere. And, you know, if you're not taxing property, if you're not imposing sales taxes and so on, you know, it's going to come in hidden fees. It's going to come in things like JEA. It's probably not going to come in air you breathe. But, you know, he makes a metaphorical point, which is that it's got to come from somewhere. You've got to look at things like gas taxes. You know, look at gasoline. Gasoline's, you know, at historic low price in terms of real dollars. And yet you don't have gas taxes on the table, and you have people talking about, you know, conservation, this and that and the other, you know, but reality, the best conservation measure is to tax something and, you know, to impose a penalty for overconsumption.
Bill is in Mandarin. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning. Gosh, this is a mammoth problem. My concern is the proposed half-cent sales tax coming up. I can't think that's going to begin to even cover the problems that we've got, especially that pension and fireman policeman fund.
Yeah, let's talk about the pension matter of the pension aspect of all of this, AG.
Right. I mean, we had a pension deal that was negotiated as Alvin Brown left office. And, you know, even with that, we're still working out the financing piece. The unfunded liability, Mayor Curry has said many times, if we don't work it out, we're the next Detroit. You know, he's not given to exaggeration on those matters. It's something where the financing piece has to be worked out. There are questions about, you know, how fully funded the pension is. I mean, our pension is less fully funded than any city, you know, in Florida. And, you know, again, that points to, you know, previous generations of politicians, you know, not being willing to say, well, let's make the books balance for real on this issue. And, you know, this is something that, you know, Mayor Cruz, you know, there's been negotiations with the new officers, but, you know, the real issue is the legacy people. The real issue is people like John Keane, who, you know, as we read about and hear about, you know, double dip, triple dip in the pension. And, you know, he's sort of a poster boy for a system run amok.
Let's go to some of your Facebook comments on the city's 90-day out at looking at Jacksonville's financial woes. Quite a few comments here. Here's one from JP. Everyone wants to live in a mansion. Few think about how much more it costs to maintain it. Jacksonville is a 50-room mansion being run on a budget more suited for a 3-bedroom, 2-bath. You can't have it both ways. Raise taxes, invest, or we'll continue to see the city crumble. Janice writes, the question is, what was the millage rate at the start of the Peyton administration, and what is it now? Look at that, and you'll see why the city needs to keep up with our infrastructure needs. Rob writes, it's easy. Elect more conservatives to office. Those are just a few of the many comments we're seeing on Facebook about this. Let's go to CJ on the South Side. Go ahead, CJ.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to say, you know, I would probably go against, at this point, the dredging project. You know, I don't think that it would bring enough economic benefit compared to how much it would actually cost, both from the budget, but also from the environmental standpoint. We just had a conversation yesterday about the St. John's River, and, you know, with all the problems that are going on, you know, I think that would be a bad thing. What I would recommend is that we actually try to think of creative ideas for revenue generation, things like transitioning off of dirty coal from JEA and, you know, doing more community solar projects. You know, that money of the dredging, $300 million or whatever, can be applied to that. We could do things like municipal fiber to be able to offer affordable 5 gigabit internet connectivity to homeowners, but also to entrepreneurs, make Jacksonville a tech hub, you know, places like Chattanooga, Tennessee, places on the West Coast. Jacksonville could be able to offer low-cost internet service, but also use that as a revenue generation. It'll be a win-win situation. You know, I think we got to get creative about this. We don't necessarily have to think about things like tolling. I think that that's a non-starter for a lot of people, and I appreciate you guys having this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, CJ.
Yeah, I mean, I see where he's coming from with, driving the infrastructure. But here's kind of the issue. You know, you've got a city council that's full of people who are self-styled fiscal conservatives. You know, you don't have people, there's not really political capital or political appetite for a tax increase. And indeed, you talk to somebody like John Crescenbeny or talk to somebody like Bill Guilford, you're trying to figure out ways to make it work more efficiently. And an ambitious infrastructure project like, universal Wi-Fi is just not on the table with this group. They can't even get the Wi-Fi in Hemming Park working right half the time, or the city Wi-Fi working right half the time. And this is like a few square block area. So I don't think Jacksonville is there.
So when the official audit is released, and if it's similar to the draft version, and Ernst & Young recommends finding more revenue, do you see City Hall ignoring the recommendations of the audit?
I don't know if they're going to ignore them, but I do expect a soft peddling of them. The David Chapman story in the Daily Record, where he got reactions from council people, had John Crescenbeny saying, well, what's new here? It's like, we know we've got these issues with the pension. We know we've got these issues, with city employees being, just not enough of them and so on. And, that's the reality is, it's going to take a concerted political effort. It's going to take pressure from citizens, basically saying we need to get the fiscal house in order. And, if people got as wrought up about that as they did about hot button social issues, then you might see some sort of fiscal rectitude. But, what we hear about, well, the developers are running the city. The developers are there talking in committee meetings, having ex parte conversations with the council people. If you want a popular resistance to it, you've got to manifest it.
Always fascinating to speak with you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Much more still ahead later. A look ahead to this month's Gullah Geechee Film and Cultural Festival in St. Augustine. Also, our book club coming up next as we share your emails. Lots of those. But right now, how you can support 89.9 with your pledge. Here's how.
And I'm Lindsay Kilbride with the news team here at WJCT. I'm here today to ask for your help. We are in the middle of our pledge drive right now. So to support us, call 904-353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528. And we really need your help. This is how, and Michelle Corum just joined me here. Morning edition host. And she's been doing this for a while.
I have, and we're reaching out to you now while we have just a couple of minutes between First Coast Connect programming to remind you that we take all credit cards, we take checks. If you want to send us a check to the address here at 100 Festival Park Avenue in Jacksonville, 32202, you could send your pledge of support that way. But every pledge counts. To all of us here, we have a lot of news programming that is costly to produce. News just tends to be one of those things. But we know that you appreciate local news, local information. Studies and surveys all bear that out. And we're trying to bring that to you. We do bring that to you. We are award winners and
yes.
In doing so. So we're very proud of our work, but we do it for you. This is your public radio station. So we're asking for your support financially to help us as we continue serving you in the community. And you can do that by making a pledge of support to 1-800-722-WJCT. That's easy. 1-800-722-WJCT on your phone, 9528. And we're trying to reach $80,000. We're at a little over $15,000. We have a way to go.
A little ways to go. But if you like what you hear, if you love Melissa Ross, First Coast Connect, you love the local shows, you love the national shows, Radio Lab, This American Life, we bring it to you all here at WJCT. So do it for yourself. If this is what you like, if this is where you get your information, then show us some support. Show us that you love us by helping support us. And the number is 904-353-9528. We also have the WJCT app, which, you can download at the App Store, any Android, iPhone, either one. You can listen there. You can also donate there. There's a donate button. Or just go to WJCT.org. There's a big yellow donate button right there in the right corner. And we are asking you to please take a click. And we accept all major credit cards, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover. And we also take checks. If If you're a check writer, we'll take whatever
or
you
walk
have.
Walk it in or however you want. just go to your phone right now and give us a call, 904-353-9528.
And we thank you.
Well, it's the dramatic story behind the story about the courageous brothers who taught the world how to fly, Wilbur and Orville Wright. In today's First Coast Connect Book Club, our book club leader, Stacy Goldring, opens the pages of The Wright Brothers by Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough. You might have checked your copy out from the Jacksonville Public Library. They're our partner for the book club. Now, for today's book club discussion, we got so many emails from listeners all sharing memories of their very first flight. We're going to share those in a moment. But first, Stacy Goldring, good to see you. And you brought something with you, which is so exciting.
I certainly did.
A scale model of the Wright B Flyer.
That's right. There it is, a little bit broken, just like the Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur's. But it really is a beautiful, delicate piece of flying machinery. And it is remarkable that these gentlemen made this happen, and so dangerous. I mean, they really put their lives on the line, and they all did it wearing starched collars and ties and nice suits, no matter the weather, no matter what. These were some determined people. But this is a great book. Let me tell you why. First of all, I want you to, if you walk away with anything about aviation today, I want you to always remember to look at your fish.
What? Your fish.
Look at your fish.
What?
Now, why would I tell you that? Well, because I'm kind of bizarre anyway. But anyone who's an aspiring writer needs to remember this term, because this is on a plaque that hangs over David McCullough's desk. What does this mean? He was taught very early on that when you write nonfiction, it is important to look at what is in front of you. And evidently, when he was at Yale, he was told about a Harvard biologist who taught his students how to observe by, on the first day of class, having all these fish in a jar. And he would slap them out on a tray, and he would put it in front of the kids and say, look at your fish, and he'd leave. And this would go on day after day until finally some brilliant kid said, aha, I get it. Paired organs, scales, gills, blah, 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 blah. And the professor would say, wonderful, now look at your fish. And this would go on and on. So what does this mean? This means that sometimes you really just have to look at what is in front of you in order to discover what you are looking for. So his thick books, this isn't even a thick one, but his books are so jam-packed with wonderful information in a readable format because he is a great observer. He is interested in his subject. You know, he was going to do a story about Picasso, but he found Picasso was rather boring. And he really didn't like him because Picasso
wasn't very likable.
No, his son evidently chained himself to a fence in order to get his dad's attention. His dad called the cops. What's with that?
Yeah.
So anyway, McCullough was like, no, we're not doing that. But anyway, McCullough had the opportunity at Yale to learn from Thornton Wilder this, that you need to give an air of freedom around your subject. So even though we know today that we fly, he does it in such a way that he puts you, the reader, right there with Orville and Wilbur, so you are unfolding the story right along with the subject. So you are on pins and needles. And I learned so many amazing things. First of all, our government poo-pooed the Wright brothers.
Sure.
They didn't trust them. They had their own
money. They were crazy.
Yeah. So the Wright brothers had to go to France. When France took a notice to the Wright brothers and Britain took notice of the Wright brothers, all of a sudden our government was like, oh, maybe we're on to something here. So that was kind of sad but interesting. Also, it's important to know that the first report of flight by the Wright brothers was reported in a beekeeper's journal in Ohio. No one believed that these guys were even doing this, because to leave the earth was almost a sacrilege.
Yeah.
It'd be almost like if all of a sudden I levitated and we're in this room alone, and besides Sean, no one would believe that actually happened. It was like they were levitating.
Yeah.
It was so incredibly unbelievable. So when no one wanted to report on it, they weren't news.
They didn't want to be seen as crazy.
No, and you being a Daytonian can probably, you know, you probably have a lot of early memories
yes.
of going on field trips, etc.
I grew up actually in Fairborn, Ohio,
okay.
which is where Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is.
Right. Patterson.
Now, and my husband's a graduate of Wright State University.
There you go. There you go.
My father was a fighter pilot in Vietnam, and then he served in the Air Guard after he went into the civil service. And when he had his retirement ceremony, it was at the Air Force Museum, which is chock full of aviation history and the Wright brothers' history. And when you grow up in Dayton and Fairborn, you grow up learning all about the Wright brothers, and you visit their museum.
That's
and so I know everything about the Wright brothers. And let me also say that when you grew up in Dayton, people up there in Dayton get a little annoyed about people saying that the first flight was in North Carolina, because it actually kind of was in Ohio.
Yes, it was.
Unofficially.
It was. Well, you know, it's so interesting because I grew up taking my field trips to a Greenfield Village Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. And what I didn't understand was why Thomas Edison's laboratory and the Wright brothers' bicycle shop were on the same street. So I thought, boy, there are a lot of smart people who grew up here at the Greenfield Village. Obviously, I was very, very young. But I don't think that the Wright brothers, we really don't feel as a nation, I don't think we're not proud of these native sons.
We don't celebrate
them
enough.
No, we don't.
That's why I'm so glad that you chose this book, The Wright Brothers, for today's segment. And what you did so brilliantly was ask our listeners to email their thoughts about their first flight. And we got a lot of emails. So I'm going to share a few of them. Diane Chapman emailed the show with her memories. In 1950, my family was living in Munich. My father, a U.S. Air Force captain, was stationed there. The Korean War just heated up. So at the age of six, I was in an MATS troop transport with dozens of kids and women, some of them pregnant and no amenities. But we thought it was a terrific adventure because we played and slept on top of the pile of parachutes at the back of the plane.
Gosh.
That's her first memory. Melissa Jolly, my first flight was with my family when I was 11. We flew from New York to Sarasota to visit relatives on Longboat Key. We flew on National Airlines, and I can still remember the tagline, a beautiful young girl saying, fly me. That was the sexist era of stewardesses.
Ouch.
I remember how amazingly loud it was inside the plane, and everyone seemed to think that was normal. And lifting up in the air felt different than I expected. Instead of feeling floaty, I felt heavy and pushed into my seat, but seeing the clouds below me was incredible. I can still see them all white and fluffy. And
very
then
special.
Anne Guest emails the show. When I was 9, my mother took me and my brother, who was 6, to visit cousins. There was no flight leaving from our home in Memphis all the way to Guatemala, so we drove to New Orleans for the departure. I was looking around for angels flying above in the clouds.
Wow.
My brother had his eyes on the propellers, and after an hour, one of them stopped altogether. In no time, the stewardess came around and tried to calm everybody down. We had to stop in Mexico City to refuel. We made it that far on just 3 propellers. The flight was uneventful, but that sure made a big impression with my classmates after I returned home. By the way, my husband's uncle, Norman McEwen, was one of many people trying to get his own flying machine in the air around the time that the Wright brothers succeeded. Long enough to get credit for inventing the airplane. Norman's relatives have a remarkable picture of him with his invention, and he remained an inventor all his life. So those are some of the emails we got
from our listeners. Isn't that incredible? Everyone always has a flying story.
Of course.
You know, everyone.
I remember when I was 10 or 11 years old flying with my brother out to see my dad in Arizona by ourselves.
Wow.
Yes, we flew by ourselves, and we had to change planes in Dallas.
Okay, so you must have taken American.
And we almost missed our connection. And I was, you know, we were preteens, and we were so afraid that
were you unaccompanied minors?
Unaccompanied, yeah.
Wow.
And we were running through the Dallas airport by ourselves.
Can you imagine?
We really were unaccompanied. There was nobody, like, with us. We were just running around the airport
alone.
That was
a long time ago.
That was a long time ago.
Far away. Yeah.
But go on, please.
Well, Tom Hanks has taken an interest in the McCullough book, so I'm happy to report it will be a series on HBO. So we will learn more about the two Wright brothers, their sister, Catherine, who was very instrumental in their success, and they also had two brothers. And their father, the Bishop Wright, was also an incredible figure in his own right, if I may say so. Incredibly powerful family, very strong family values, and the father never, it seemed like he never worried. He never worried these guys were going up in the air. Absolutely incredible. And nothing, you know, I have to worry about them socially. Neither of them married. They were so dedicated to the idea that they were going to make this work, that the King of England could be standing next to them. And, you know, they would check to make sure this thingy was on tight and this is screwed in right and what's the weather like. And oh, we're closing up because it's not good weather. I mean, nothing fazed these men. And they were good businessmen. They had the bicycle shop, which they were able to fund their expeditions down to Kitty Hawk, where I'm going this week, as a result of this book.
Oh, very nice.
They were even able to be businessmen in order to fund their operation, which cost nothing compared to the thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that our government was pouring to another program that was doomed from the start. So it's kind of interesting, too. If anything, this book inspires you to take a risk and go for it. So if anyone is sitting and thinking, I don't know, I can't risk it, I am telling you to look at your fish, analyze it, and do it.
That's right. See things in a new way.
That's right. In a new light.
And it's so exciting to get this incredible participation in our First Coast Connect book club.
Yes, we appreciate that.
Emails always come to bookclub@wjct.org. Our partner, the Jacksonville Public Library, providing these copies of The Wright Brothers to our listeners. Also, Chamberlain's and the Book Nook. Thanks for your participation. Now, next month, you've got another project you want to share.
I do. It's going to be the great year, 1939, and we're going to talk about books that were made into fabulous films. We're going to have David Luckin on with us, and we're going to talk about all about those fabulous, fabulous books that were made into movies in this incredible year. And we're going to, in tandem, if anyone is interested in participating in what I'm calling a Blix series, where we will...
Books made into movies.
Yes.
Blix.
Yes, Blix. What we're doing is we're putting together a program where we can go and watch these films, talk about the books, talk about the movies, maybe have some popcorn, maybe a glass of wine. I don't know.
It probably was the greatest year in Hollywood.
Yeah. Oh.
Gone with the Wind.
Yes.
The Wizard
mm-hmm.
of Oz.
Of Mice and Men. Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. The
Wasn't
Hounds
that
of
also... Citizen Kane?
Yes.
Yeah.
The list goes on and on. It's like 10 pages worth of Wikipedia stuff if you were just going to hop onto one site and look. It's absolutely remarkable what was churned out that year.
So now let's ask our listeners to email us with their favorite film from that year.
Favorite film and... or any film that you have that has been turned into a movie. But if it's particularly from 1939, not only your favorite, but why. I want to know why.
Right. So we'll email the book club now. What's your favorite book that's been made into a movie, whether it was from 1939 or any year?
That's
Send
right.
your emails to Stacy in the book club. Bookclub@wjct.org.
Thank you.
So good to see you.
Same, same.
And we'll be right back.
Join WJCT on Tuesday, October 27 at the WJCT studios for a reception at 6, followed at 7 by a preview of The Chaplains, a film from Martin Doblmeyer that goes inside the dynamic and fast-changing world of chaplains, men and women who are trained to be of comfort and support to people of all faiths, or to those who profess no faith. After the preview, Martin will lead a discussion. The event is free and open to the public, but reservations are required. Log on to wjct.org/events to register.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
So, where do you listen to WJCT?
Hi, this is Tracy in Jacksonville. We have 89.9 on in our car all the time, and I keep it on in the background at work. The only more avid fan in our family is my 6-year-old.
WJCT is here for you anytime, anywhere. Call now with your pledge of support, 904-353-9528. WJCT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit now through November 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Well, finally, this hour, it's an exciting and unique cultural event coming up in St. Augustine celebrating this region's Gullah Geechee heritage. The Gullah Geechee were African people who were forced into slavery in southern coastal states. They developed a separate Creole language and a distinct culture that included more of their African traditions than African-American populations in other parts of the U.S. The Gullah Geechee corridor stretches from North Carolina all the way to St. Johns County. Governor Rick Scott recently issued a proclamation declaring October Gullah Geechee Awareness Month in Florida. And coming up on the 29th, you can learn more at the Gullah Geechee Film and Cultural Festival in St. Augustine. Here with a preview, author Derek Boyd Hankerson, who helped put the event together. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Ann Chin, Executive Director of the Middle Passage Ceremonies and Port Marker Project. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa.
Derek, you're the author of The Civil War South We Never Knew, and you've been working for years to build awareness about this area's Gullah Geechee history and this festival, so this is a real triumph for you.
It's huge. It's huge and humbling, Melissa. It's humbling because I heard of these stories from my parents and relatives growing up as a kid, dating back to when I was about 10 years old. And of course, I was always inspired by the rich history that exists in the South. Unfortunately or unfortunately, I grew up inside the Beltway in Maryland, and we were always indoctrinated with British history. So when I would travel, or our family would travel from the North to the South, I was always embedded with oral history from relatives. And one of the stories that I learned, or two of the stories that I learned from my parents and relatives, was that my grandmother on my father's side was Gullah Geechee, and my great 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 grandfather on my mother's side was Geechee. So I grew up with these stories of these West Africans who, I like to say, immigrated to the New World, and they settled on the Sea Islands and formed some of the first Maroon communities, some of the first militias, and were instrumental in forming the South and Southern ways to include music, dance, arts, culture, and food.
Ann Chin, this festival will feature film, music, art, food, and it will educate people about this incredible, rich cultural heritage. Can you talk a little bit about the history of the Gullah Geechee, and in particular, how, their isolation on the barrier islands of the southeastern U.S. Helped this culture flourish in a distinct sort of way?
Sure. I mean, I think that, first of all, Florida has the longest and most extensive history with African presence. The Gullah Geechee are unique in that because of what they were brought here, their skills to do rice production and also indigo, they were isolated in many ways. They were on basically the coast and the barrier islands. So that those whose plantations they worked were pretty much sort of, if you would just raise the crop, you know, you can continue pretty much whatever your culture, whatever your language, whatever your habits were, just produce. And so you had from North Carolina down to Florida this idea of these people who were, again, isolated. And then repeatedly over 150 years, you had new Africans, what they call saltwater Africans, coming into that community. And so it helped maintain a culture that in other areas of the United States, I think that Africans and their descendants were more influenced by European and even Native American culture.
What were some of the hallmarks, or what are some of the hallmarks of the culture that helped it stand apart?
Well, I think because they were, and I'll let Derek expand on that, but I think that the idea that they were left alone and that they were pretty much focused on organizing themselves to produce, I think it made a difference. And so people were able to figure out how to survive.
Derek.
We are talking about a group of people who were rich, not just in the production of rice. They, as Zand eloquently stated, taught the plantation owners how to grow rice. They were the most important, they were the most important ingredient with reference to rice production, but we're also talking about people who made sweet water baskets. We're also talking about people who were blacksmiths. We're talking about people who were carpenters. And also, you will see at the film festival on October 29th at the Corazon in St. Augustine, you'll see saltwater basket making. You'll see blacksmithing demonstrations. You'll also see the infamous ring shouters, and that is a dance that West Africans do, and the Macintosh dancers actually performed for Pope Francis when he was here in America. And this group of West Africans were pretty much the staple of everything to include food. We're talking collard greens, we're talking chitlins, we're talking fatback. All the rich southern or soul food that we eat today is based upon what slaves were cooking back in the day.
And this is coming up in St. Augustine on October 29th, the culmination of a lot of work.
Well, it is a lot of work, Melissa. And what's really unique about this whole area, to include Jacksonville, Cosmos, Franklintown, La Villa, Lincolnville, Armstrong, these are all communities that were settled in 1866 after the Civil War, after General William Tecumseh Sherman confiscated 400,000 acres of Confederate land from the Confederates, of course, to build these neighborhoods for these newly freed slaves. Actually, it were West African, about 13 West African Gullah Geechee ministers who met with General Sherman after the Civil War. These ministers wanted to provide these newly freed slaves a means of self-sufficiency. So a lot of the black families that were enslaved, and first let me add that not all blacks were slaves and not all slaves were black, but those that fought or those that were freed after the Civil War did get 40 acres. And there are neighborhoods in Florida that are a reflection of that, to include Lincolnville in St. Johns County and Armstrong in St. Johns County that were settled in 1866.
Right. The infamous 40 acres and a mule, directly tied to the Gullah Geechee population. People right. don't understand that necessarily.
Not at all.
Right. And, yeah. and that proclamation or dictate was signed in Charleston, South Carolina. And a lot of folks, you know, are still jokingly saying, where are my 40 acres and a mule? But again, the sense that people had to become self-sustaining, you know, it was not a welfare system. It was not, you know, in any level that people were looking for a handout. I mean, it was simply, this is freedom and we need to survive.
Well, this is so exciting that this is coming together, and it's sort of a bookend to the big 450th celebrations in St. Augustine, which have recently
yes.
concluded.
Yes.
Another part of St. Augustine's incredibly rich history. So come on out and celebrate the Gullah Geechee Film Festival on October 29th in St. Augustine. This is open to the public, coming up at the Corazon Cinema and Cafe on Granada Street in St. Augustine.
That's correct, and it's free and open to the public. And Melissa, the reason why we had the festival on the Thursday was to, it's a no-brainer, but to invite the school children. Here's an opportunity for children students to learn about this rich history, learn about this rich culture, to learn about performance, to learn about dance, and also to see some really incredible films, to include Florida Crossroads, Language You Cry In, Ben Yan, There's No Place Like Home, and several other films that are just based on the Gullah Geechee history and rich culture.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Author Derek Boyd Hankerson and Ann Chin, Executive Director of the Middle Passage Ceremonies and Port Marker Project. Again, that Gullah Geechee Film and Cultural Festival set for October 29th in St. Augustine. Diane Reams up next, but right now we need you to support 89.9. Here's how.
And you can do that by picking up the phone now while you have a minute and calling us here at WJCT. The number here to Pledge Drive Central is 904-353-9528. Again, that's 904-353-9528. Michelle Corum here appealing to you, and also Lindsay Kilbride from our news department.
Hello.
We are here to take a moment to talk to you about how important it is to help out the Fall Radio Pledge Drive.
Yeah, so give us a call. The number again, 353-9528, and tell us why you're pledging. Is it because you love what you just heard on First Coast Connect? Is it because you love our local newscast? Or maybe it's because we brought back Prairie Home Companion. I know a lot of people are very excited about that, but that programming is not cost-free.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Programming does cost a lot. Of the shows that we play on WJCT, the cost of those collectively is really huge. Radio programming for 1 year, did you know this, costs about $410,000, and if you break that down, that's about $1,200 a day. $1,200 a day. But that's really a small amount when everybody thinks about, how much does this program appeal to me? How much do I use it? Am I tuning in every day? Am I listening to certain programming, both television, radio? Am I using the radio reading service for the visually impaired? What part of WJCT am I utilizing in my life? And then break that down into a dollar amount, and we can easily get to that $1,200 a day to bring you the quality programming that you love. So do your part to help ensure that it's around for all of us 365 days a year, and make that contribution right now by calling 904-353-9528.
And we also have a great little gift to give you guys. If you become a monthly sustainer, that's $10 a month, or it's just $120 one-time gift if you wanted to go ahead and get it out of the way. You'll get a WJCT t-shirt. It says, I heart WJCT, with our Your Community, Your World underneath it. It's a great blue-gray, super soft. And
it is, and thin. So nice for Florida. Yeah,
everyone
you know,
will know
a thick
you're a
t-shirt.
Everyone will know you're a great sustainer.
Yeah, very comfortable. So be comfortable in your t-shirt and your mug and your tote bag and whatever you've had from the past, and get it all together and give us a call here. There's an 800 number, 1-800-722-9528. 800-722-9528. So give us a call here to WJCT. It's our fall pledge drive. We are so thankful to all of you who have already thought of us and made your pledge of support, but we're now into the last days and getting into the week. So give us a call right away to WJCT, and thanks for your support.